Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Every day as we move through our daily routine, we're constantly being nudged to make a choice in a particular way. Most are beneficial to us, others less so. Look at our daily commute by car. We're reminded to buckle up. Some models once upon a time forced us to buckle up, but today we're just reminded with a ding, ding, ding. If you're absent-minded while driving, new models will let us know when we're drifting across our lane. It reminds us to take our keys when we reach our destination. These are nudges put in place by a choice architect to help make our lives easier. In contrast, things like cash rebates, which offer a lower price but which are difficult to collect on, subscriptions to publications that are almost impossible to unsubscribe to, our system of taxation with all its complexities, these are examples of sludge. Both terms have been popularized by my guest today, behavioral economist and 2017 Nobel laureate Richard Thaler of the University of Chicago. He and legal scholar Cass Sunstein popularized nudging in the world of business, government, and design in their 2008 bestseller, Nudge. They're back with a revised and extended edition, Nudge the Final Edition, which explains the behavioral economics in play in all of our decision-making and how most nudging helps us make better choices, while some encourage us to make poor choices, and where nudging is effective and not, like considering vaccinations today, or issues like climate change. There they say shoving might be more effective. Richard Thaler is my guest today to talk about his new book, Nudge, the Final Edition. Richard Thaler, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Happy to be with you today.
Yes. Nudge, I really enjoyed reading this book. I missed it in its first edition. But as a behavioral economist, what do you mean by nudge?
So a nudge is something in the environment that captures our attention and alters our behavior without forcing us to do anything. So one of my favorite examples is just GPS. I have one of the worst sense of directions of anybody. Unless my wife is with me, I always used to get lost. But now I've got GPS on my phone, and I don't get lost anymore. And the nice thing about the GPS is it's not a backseat driver. It says, go left here, but if you don't feel like it, it just recomputes. So nudges are kind of weak. I think my co-author Cass may have a worse sense of direction than me. So both of us would kind of like GPS for everything in life. If you're trying to balance your budget or figure out which healthcare plan to choose or how much to save for retirement, it ought to be as easy as it is to buy a copy of our book or ask Alexa to turn on the local NPR station. But lots of things are hard, and so if we can provide some nudges, we can make life easier.
It's interesting, as I'm reading through the book, and it's hard to tell what was in the original edition and what was added for this new final edition, as you term it. But it was a pleasure to read about the many ways we're being nudged in a good way. Like, for example, I know this wasn't the case in 2008, that if you use an ATM, today you have to take your card back before the money is dispensed, and so you have very little chance of leaving your card at the ATM. As you were revising the book, were you surprised by how many nudges have entered our daily life today?
Well, not surprised because we've been watching. So that example actually appears in the original as, shouldn't it be this way? And now it is. Another example in the original was, remember, it used to be that the cap on your gas tank in your car, somebody in some car company realized, for about 5 cents, we can put a little plastic thing on it so that you don't lose it. Now, after somebody had that idea, why every car company didn't immediately adopt it, I have no idea, but I think it's now pretty universal. So things like this obvious nudges have become much more commonplace. And, you know, my car beeps if I get too close to the car in front of me or the car next to me, and that's a very good thing.
Yeah, no. And automobiles are an excellent example of ways in which we're being nudged in all sorts of things. You earlier used the example of how to choose your health insurance. And, of course, if you have employer-provided health insurance, this is another area that's seen a lot of nudges, because in the old days, you had a sign-up period, and if you missed it, you might have to wait a year to make a change. And now I think most HR departments are very proactive in nudging you to make sure that you fill out the form, that you, and most of it is now online, and it's very easy to fill out as opposed to, you know, lots of paperwork to do. Have you seen big changes in that area?
Well, the biggest change is one that I played some role in making happen, which is in retirement plans and 401k plans, so any defined contribution plan. In the early days, you had to sign up for that. Now, an economist would say, well, if your employer is giving a match, this is a no-brainer. You know, many employers match 50 cents on the dollar, so if you don't sign up, you're just throwing money away. So no one would fail to sign up. Well, that's not true. If you have to fill out some piece of paper and take it to the right place and fill out a bunch of forms, many people, like half the people, would fail to sign up originally. So we encouraged firms to start doing what's called automatic enrollment, which means they sign you up unless you choose not to join. That gets enrollment up to about 90%. Pretty magical.
Yeah.
That was step one. Unfortunately, the rates at which people were automatically enrolled were too low, so we created a solution to that that we called Save More Tomorrow, which reflects the idea that we all have more self-control for the future. So we're planning diets, well, maybe next month, and that's when we'll join the gym, too. So using that idea, we said, how about if you agree to increase your saving rate 1% each year every time you get a raise? Well, the first company that we finally convinced to try that, saving rates tripled over time. And I can now say that most big companies use both of these ideas. And at one point, we tried to calculate how much more savings there were, and that calculation is out of date, but it's in the many billions. So it would be nice if all the aspects of the HR department were being run as smoothly as that. I don't think that's the case, and actually health insurance is one that we talk about in the book. Many people are in a plan that an economist would say that the plan they're choosing is dominated, which means that they're essentially paying more no matter how much healthcare they consume. And so here's a simple rule of thumb that we mention in the book, which is, when in doubt, take the biggest deductible. And in health insurance, that will often save you lots and lots of money, no matter how much health care you consume.
Really? Now, even if you're in poor health and you know you're going to reach your deductible during the course of a given year?
Sometimes, especially if you're in bad health. But in the case of these dominated plans, yes. In fact, at my employer, if you choose the lower deductible, you lose in no matter what. So many of the people in the business school and economics department have figured this out, but not everybody. And in fact, most of the faculty are in the wrong plan.
Now, in most insurance, I know that's a good idea to take the highest deductible allowed, because the fact that most of the time on a home insurance, car insurance, you're not going to have that many claims, and yet you're paying a lot more for a lower deductible, and it never adds up. And your book also mentions that as well. I want to move on for just a second, because at the very beginning of the book, and you use a term for all of these nudges, and it's a funny term. It's a wonderful non sequitur. Libertarian parentalism, which I know probably...
Paternalism.
Excuse me.
Well, parentalism would be less sexist, so maybe we should have called it that, but it would make it even more arcane. So we call it libertarian paternalism.
Paternalism. And again, these are two diametrically opposed phrases, how we expect to hear them. What do you mean by it, and how do you reconcile that?
We love this term. Everyone else hates it, but which may have something to do with why we chose it. But we use libertarian in this context as an adjective. So we want to say, and by paternalism, we just mean helping people. Now, normally people think of paternalism as coercion. So we force you to join Social Security because we think it's good for you. But you can care about people then not force them. So that's the idea of libertarian paternalism. It's caring about the outcomes, but doing it in a way that doesn't force anybody to do anything. And that's the philosophy. We don't think we can solve every problem that way. And in fact, we say so in the book many times. But when we can, that's kind of nice that we can help people without forcing anybody to do anything.
My guest today is Richard Thaler, a Nobel laureate in economics. He's a prize-winning behavioral economist at the University of Chicago. He's co-author, along with Cass Sunstein, of Nudge, the final edition, which is a new edition of the 2008 bestseller. Well, what were some of the major revisions you had to make for this particular book?
Well, I don't know which ones we had to make, but we, you know, it's funny. We were nudged by an accident, which is the paperback edition of the book. The contract with Penguin, the publisher, had expired. It turned out it had expired a year and a half ago by the time somebody noticed it. And so we got a letter saying, we negotiated a new contract, and the Penguin like maybe for you guys to write a new chapter or something, freshen it up. And, you know, this was about April of 2020. And you remember there wasn't a lot to do.
Exactly. So,
but we each found a copy of the book at home in our home offices where we were spending a lot of time. And I started reading it, and I kept wincing. And so we started rewriting little bits and pieces, and then we fell into what we call the while you're at it trap, which anybody who's done a home improvement project is completely familiar with. You know, you start by just replacing the refrigerator and dishwasher in your kitchen, and pretty soon it's a $100,000 project. So we ended up rewriting, I'd say, three quarters of the book. And part of it is because there wasn't that much else to do, and part of it is because we got carried away.
Well, before we talk about one of the new sections of the book, you refer to the art of nudging as being a choice architect. What is a choice architect, and what is choice architecture?
Well, you know, there's this old line that somebody discovered that they had been speaking prose without knowing it. And we're all choice architects in some aspect of our lives, and we deal with choice architecture all the time. So a good example is if you go to a restaurant and there's a menu, somebody is in charge of creating that menu. And even if the chef has decided what food will be offered, the menu designer has all kinds of choices to make. Should appetizers be different than soups or salads, a separate category? And what about desserts? Are they on a completely different page that they bring you later? And then what order should things appear? Now, in a model of the world that economists typically write about, in which everybody are these super rational creatures that we call econs, fictional creatures, none of this would matter because people would just choose the things that would make them happiest. And things like the order in which they appear and what category wouldn't matter. But all of this matters. Essentially, everything matters. So a choice architect is somebody who is arranging the environment in which you choose. And that can help or hurt. Think about a company like Amazon. If you walked into a physical store that had every book ever that's still in print and some that aren't, you'd be run away as quickly as possible, right? It would be some vast warehouse that would be impossible to navigate. And obviously Jeff Bezos isn't that dumb. There's a reason he's so rich. And so one of the reasons that Amazon has been successful is that they manage to be able to sell you essentially anything. And now, essentially anything, and it can come tomorrow, including Nudge, the final edition, I might add. But you can do that with a couple clicks. So if you think of the companies that have become amazingly successful, like Amazon, like Apple, like Google, partly they've become so successful because they're so good at choice architecture. And the same with Netflix. You know, we've all spent way more time streaming over the last year and a half than we had before. And Netflix and Amazon Prime and the other streaming services make finding a show you want to watch easy, and they make suggestions. And this is all choice architecture.
Yeah. I love one of your examples. It's a ballot for in 1938 when Germany was asked to approve the reunification of Austria and to vote for Adolf Hitler. The ballot, if you said yes, the circle was about 2.5 times larger than no. That's another type of choice architecture,
right,
isn't it?
That is choice architecture. Now, another new feature in the book that I'm sure you noticed is that we have a new chapter on what we call sludge.
Yes.
And that would be a good example of sludge. This is, you know, for years I've been signing copies of the book with the phrase nudge for good, which is meant as a plea. And it's a plea because we didn't invent nudging. Nudging existed, you know, Adam and Eve. I don't know, you know, who was nudging whom, but humans have always nudged. So, and you can nudge for good or you can nudge for evil. Hitler was he didn't limit himself to nudging, but, and he certainly wasn't nudging for good. So, sludge is using the same tools of choice architecture, but for purposes that don't make people better off.
You use the example of the unsubscribing hook, which is you subscribe to something and to read a review of Nudge, and then you found that unsubscribing was a pretty difficult task.
Yes. I take some pleasure in the fact that good choice architecture has become more commonplace, but so has sludge. And making it difficult to unsubscribe seems to be very common. In fact, I have an op-ed in the Washington Post this week about sludge, and it includes the unsubscribe app. And I published it in the Washington Post because it is the only leading news outlet that lets you unsubscribe with one click. And I figured it was appropriate to publish it there. But this is an example of how pointing things out can help readers, even if they're not choice architects. Before you join something, it's a good idea to find out what you have to do to unjoin. And gyms are notorious at this. They have trial offers that are very inexpensive, and then they automatically enroll you in a regular membership, which is much more expensive, and getting out of it can be as difficult as doing one of these workouts. I read about one gym that was requiring people to show up in person to quit in the height of the pandemic, even though the gym was closed. So that is sludge.
Yeah. Rebates is another area where, you know, you often, instead of giving a rebate right there or a lower price, you have to fill it in. And the idea is you will never fill it in and send it in and send it to the right place and get the money back. And shrouded attributes. And this is, you know, for men, this is a big issue. Razors. Razors are cheap. Razor blades are very expensive.
Well, that's right. You know, this is, some things are very old. And Mr. Gillette got very rich on this principle. And it's still true for razors, but the modern version of it is printers. So printers are very cheap. You can buy a very nice printer for $200. And the reason is they're making the money on the ink. And nowhere, you know, I was praising Amazon that it's very easy to find anything, and that would include printers. But good luck finding out how much it will cost to actually print things with this printer, because that's what you use it for. And that requires ink. And most of the major producers of printers require you to buy the ink cartridges from them for your protection, of course, so that you don't damage the printer. And as anybody who has a printer knows, those ink cartridges are really expensive, even more than razor blades.
My guest today is Richard Thaler, Nobel Prize-winning behavioral economist at the University of Chicago. He's co-author with Cass Sunstein of Nudge, the Final Edition. And in our last couple of minutes, I want to ask about COVID nudges. We've certainly seen a lot of nudges with the vaccine, and most have been relatively ineffective. You know, techniques that you write about in the book, like lotteries, you know, immediate cash payments, incentives to get the vaccine have seemed to be mostly ineffective. What are some effective COVID nudges or vaccine nudges at this particular time that you'd like to see?
Well, I think there were lots of nudges that helped early on, but they helped because we were dealing mostly with people who wanted the vaccine. And all we needed to do was make it easy. And offering free beers and donuts and lotteries and things like that helped, but they're not going to help the one-third of people that are still holding off on their first shot. These people are going to need more than a nudge. And I think the National Football League is giving us a good model for how to do this. There were lots of players that were reluctant to get their vaccine. And the league said, you don't have to be vaccinated, But your life is going to be a lot more difficult if you aren't. And you're going to have to wear a mask. And a key thing is they're still doing lots of testing. If you get a positive test and you're unvaccinated, you're quarantined for 10 days, which means you miss at least one game. And whereas if you're vaccinated and you get a positive test, chances are very good it's a false positive. They just, don't practice that day, get another test tomorrow, and two negative tests and you're back on the field. So they are already up to 90% with at least one with one shot, and hope to do much better. So I think this is where we're going to have to go. This is well beyond nudging. This is incentives. But for important problems like this or like climate change, which we have a chapter about,
yes,
we need to go beyond nudging and pushing, shoving, and incentives. We could have a mandate, by the way. Governments have chosen not to do that, though there's plenty of precedent for doing it. George Washington inoculated his troops against smallpox, and that's one reason that we're no longer part of the United Kingdom.
Well, you know, I think one of the most effective that seems to be happening now with the Delta variant is that the news that 95% of all hospitalizations are the unvaccinated. That probably makes a bigger impact than any sort of other incentives could be.
Well, except that people aren't very good at dealing with probabilities. And the fact that, if a vaccine is 90% effective, that means 10% of the people who are exposed may get it. And as the number of people who are vaccinated goes up, the percentage of people who get sick that are vaccinated will go up. So in Israel, where almost everybody is vaccinated, many of the people who get COVID have been vaccinated because that's all there is.
Yeah.
So the headlines are not often filtered through somebody who's familiar with statistics. But you're right that the news that you really need to be aware of is the vaccine will almost certainly keep you out of the hospital and keep you alive and will do the same for your family. So do yourself a favor and get vaccinated.
That's a nudge right there. From Richard Thaler. Richard Thaler, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Richard Thaler is a Nobel Prize-winning behavioral economist at the University of Chicago, and he's co-author, along with Cass Sunstein, of Nudge, the Final Edition, a new edition of their 2008 bestseller, which is published by Penguin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.